Charlotte takes a deep breath, tries to clear her head, runs through his script again in his head. Approaches from the front, not the back. First one smiles, says hi, he says hi back, lets her go. Another one approaches him asking questions, letting him know she doesn't know where he's going, letting him know she's vulnerable, a target of opportunity if there ever was one. And he doesn't take her. Why? Is he hunting for a physical attribute? She and Luke have spent days now studying everything they could find about the victims, including Elle Schaefer, even though her connection isn't definitive yet. Sarah Pratt, Kelly Sumter, Elle Schaefer. All three mid-twenties and white. At 5'6", Sarah Pratt was the tallest of the bunch, with Kelly and Elle coming in right behind her at 5'2 and 5'4 respectively. The physical similarities end there. Hair color, eye color, facial features, they're all wildly different. Kelly Sumter was a stick figure with a great mane of bottle blonde hair and a love of cheap, flashy jewelry. Sarah Pratt, a svelte fitness nut and redhead, who kept her hair military-grade short and wore halter tops that proudly flashed a tattoo on her shoulder, inspired by a series of vampire romance novels she loved. As for Elle, she was a full-figured tomboy who eschewed dresses and had trouble smiling in pictures. The jog that might have ended her life was, according to her work friends, one of her first. It's not about them, she realizes. It's about him. He approaches them from the front so they can see him. The bus makes a dramatic left turn. It's time to text Luke. Coming into the lot, she writes. Okay. He's getting out of the Camry. The bus is slowing down. I need to put the phone away, she writes. Okay. She's already deleted all the text messages from earlier that week. Now it's time to delete the ones from Luke. But her finger hesitates, and another one pops through just as the brakes hiss, and the shuttle slows to a gradual halt. Charlie?
Yeah?
Whatever happens, knock him dead. Smiley face. Hey, Luke, she types back.
Yeah?
Thanks for doing right by me. A few seconds tick by, and then... XO. The shuttle stops. The other passengers get to their feet. She hangs back, letting them wrestle their suitcases out from the racks on either side of the middle exit door. She deletes all of Luke's messages from that night. First, the mother and her two sons head out into the dark, then the couple with their now energetic pug. She feels a twinge of guilt, as if she's allowing these unsuspecting travelers to swim out into waters where a shark lies in wait. But this shark doesn't have a taste for people like them. Will he have a taste for me? Amazing that this is what's occupying her mind in this moment. That her life has brought her to this point, desperate to snare the attention of a human monster. But if he passes her by like he did the other two, they'll have to start over. Once he's laid eyes on her, assessed her, and for some reason judged her wanting, her hopes of baiting him will be forever dashed. Luke's left the Jeep empty, and she's got a key to it if she has to walk that far. But for now, she walks slowly, with a bowed head. Eye contact seems enough to drive the guy away. Eye contact and engagement. But still, he approaches the women from the front. He's got a trigger, just like Zypraxin does, she thinks. He's not rejecting these women because of what they are, but because of something they do. Or something they don't do. She hears footsteps approaching her through the dark. She grabs the straps of her backpack, keeps staring at the ground, lifts her view just enough that she can see a man's legs approaching. And the sight of his legs reminds her of the way he moved through the gym the other day. Of his perfectly muscled body. His perfectly muscled body, contrasting with his imbalanced, slightly altered mess of a face. With a surge of excitement that borders on giddiness, it comes to her. He rejected them because they were nice. They're paces from each other now. He rejected them because they didn't reject him. She looks at his face, looks right into his eyes. He's watching her with an intensity that belies his quick, confident steps. And that's when she winces and quickly looks away as if repulsed by what she sees. They pass each other, and then she hears his footsteps stop. I got him, she thinks. I fucking got him! Too late, she realizes what she forgot to do. She forgot to be afraid. The impact is swift, instant, and skull-rattling. Suddenly her torso, neck, and head seem to weigh nothing at all. The next thing she knows, she's kissing asphalt with no memory of the faceplant itself. Her mind grabs for terror. Nothing is there. She's hollow, vacant. Never in her life has she been truly stunned in the most literal and physical definition of the word. Terror seems like a rational thought process her body can't accommodate, and the more she tries to summon it, the more she pushes it away. As if she were trying to meditate on the calm in the middle of a thunderstorm. It's like she's breathing through a straw. Her knees scrape the asphalt. He's dragging her in between two parked cars. He stuffs something in her mouth, something soaked in a noxious chemical. She feels it the way you feel your bedsheets when you're first coming to in the morning. And then the prick of a needle. My neck, fuck. My neck, he just... And when the darkness closes in around her, she realizes he beat it. He beat the Zyprexin, and whatever he's injected her with is flooding her system. He beat it because she was too busy playing detective and psychologist. She forgot her most important role. Victim. Luke knew this part would be hard. They discussed it multiple times. What it would mean to watch her go limp and not react. What it would take to just sit there and watch her give herself to the guy so he'd feel safe stuffing her into his trunk. But the hardest part is watching Pemberton's speed and efficiency. It would be easier if he growled or snarled like a monster, but for him this is just routine, jamming a woman in his trunk like luggage. Even the way he brought the blackjack down across the back of her head was clean, precise. Now he's placing her carry-on in the back seat as if it's his. The Camry's headlights wink on. To Marty, Brasher, Rucker, and the two guys on watch in Temecula, Luke texts, "We're a go. En route." Luke waits for the Camry to head for the exit, then brings up the brightness on both tablets affixed to the dash. A few seconds later, there's a knock at the window. It's Marty and his boys. Luke unlocks the doors. The boys slide in back, Marty in the front.
"Motherfuck, man," Marty growls.
"Motherfuck, I mean this better."
"Easy," Luke says.
"I know. I know. I watched it too."
The Camry's tracker is live on one tablet. He's logged in on the second, as evidenced by the square of lighter darkness in the center of the screen. The contact lenses are live, he's sure of it. The trunk is just dark.
"Her head, man. He hit her in her fucking head, man."
"Marty," Luke says firmly. "Take a breath, okay? I get it. But take a breath. This is what was supposed to happen."
Marty's lips sputter, and he grips the handle next to his arm and nods.
"We're good," Luke says, starting the engine. "Everything's good. We're rolling and we'll have him soon."
Luke pulls out of the parking lot. As the exit booth comes into view, he sees the Camry's taillights swing out onto the service road.
"Something's wrong."
It's Ed Baker who says it first, but they are all feeling it. The entire crew sitting in front of the bank of computer screens. The warehouse is air-conditioned, thank God, otherwise their combined sweat would be stinking up the place. And if there's anything Cole hates more than waiting, it's body odor. They were able to watch most of Charlie's walk through the terminals on hacked airport surveillance cams, as well as through her true glass. But only once she made it to the parking lot did Cole stop pacing. It's not just the suspense of watching. He's never worked this closely with these team members before, and that makes Ed nervous. And Ed getting nervous makes him nervous. No compartmentalization means no plausible deniability if things go wrong, if certain hacks are discovered. An airport, he kept thinking. Why did all of this have to focus on an airport? No way can he launch micro-drones yards away from two major active runways. Now they're staring at the hazy black square offered up by Charlotte's true glass.
We sure it's live? Ed asks.
One of the computer techs says,
It shows as live and I don't see any interruption in the signal since she left the terminal.
The center of the screen's lighter than everything around it, Cole says. She's live. She's just keeping her eyes closed for some reason.
Why?
Ed asks.
Why is she keeping her eyes closed? She's in the fucking trunk. He can't see her.
Maybe she's opening them and there's no light source?
Another tech asks.
Something's wrong,
Ed growls. Cole's phone rings. He expects it to be another call from Dylan, another call he plans to ignore. But it's not. It's a call he should have prepared for, but he's had a lot to prepare for over the last few days, so this particular possibility didn't get a dress rehearsal. Julia Crispin says,
Tell me you have teams in place.
No doubt she's been sitting in front of her laptop in her mirrored basement office in Rancho Santa Fe, sipping her drink of choice while tending to paperwork, and occasionally glancing over at Charlotte's feed like it's a nostalgic TV rerun. From the tone of her voice, it sounds like she's just realized this won't be an episode of The Golden Girls.
So you've been checking in on us?
Cole asks. It's my technology. I'll do whatever I want with it. Tell me you've prepared for this, Cole.
A lot has gone into this night, Julia, and it's better if I don't tell you about any of it. That way, if something doesn't go exactly as planned, then...
Cole. Her voice is frosty enough to silence him.
If something happens to that woman, there will be consequences. Well, I'm sorry, but something is happening to that woman, and it's the result of a series of choices she's made.
Choices forced on her by Dylan Cody and now you.
If you don't have teams in place, get them in place now, Cole, because if that woman doesn't make it out of this, I will fucking ruin you and your family's company, and every last member of your family. Do you understand me?
But it must be a rhetorical question, because she hangs up before Cole can answer, and before he can point out the potential self-inflicted wounds inherent in such an endeavor. When he turns back to the monitor bank, Ed's studying him. Cole waves his concern away.
Do we have real-time traffic? He asks.
The web tech says,
Yeah, they're 45 minutes out.
Good. My bird's gassed up, right?
Ed nods.
Good,
Cole says, as if everything's going to plan.
Get closer,
Marty says, for what must be the 10th time.
Marty, we talked about this.
Luke's trying to focus, even relax himself a bit. They're traveling the reverse of the route Pemberton took on the night of the Camry stash, and that's good. That means he's behaving as expected, taking them to the Temecula house. This is the time to focus, get their breath. But Marty's decided it's time for a freakout. In the back seat, the boys are quiet. But in the rearview mirror, Luke catches glimpses of their eyes moving back and forth between him and Marty like dogs following a tennis ball.
We can't see her, for fuck's sake,
Marty barks.
We can see her, right there,
Luke says, pointing to the GPS tablet.
Marty, I've been tailing him for days. If he recognizes the Jeep and panics when he's got her in the trunk, we're in uncharted territory. That's what the tracker's for.
Why is it dark, though?
Marty points to the contact lens feed.
Why is it so damn dark? Shouldn't she be blinking, doing something we can see? If he's moving bodies in that trunk, he's going to take out the light sources, if there are any.
But not even any cracks, maybe light around the edge of the roof? Come on, Luke!
For the first time, he thinks Marty's got a point. But he also thinks Marty's reactive and maybe not as cut out for this kind of operation as he thought he'd be. Charlie's objective could not be any clearer. Make the guy believe she's a prostrate victim until she can overpower him when he's surrounded by evidence of his crimes. Any sudden moves before then could blow the whole thing, pitching their operation into a half-assed arrest of Pemberton, a bullshit cover story, and potential evidence lost to rich lawyers and more denied warrants. But there's something else that's nagging at him. The drive time. If they continue at their current rate, Charlie will only have a little less than an hour left on her Zyprexin after they reach the vineyard.
"Your guy's at the surveillance point," Luke says.
"What'll it take them to get close to the house?"
"Not much. We staked out possible positions yesterday. Wasn't much else to do up there."
"They're armed?" Luke asks.
"Oh, yeah.
Tell them to get in place, just in case."
Marty sighs, starts typing into his burner. Relieved and calmed some, it seems, just to have something to do. And he's relieved that Marty's not still pressuring him to ride the Camry's ass. He sees the sign for CA-79. A short stint on that will bring them to the entrance to Pala Temecula Road. Ahead of them, the tracker takes that very route. More good signs. On the GPS map, the mountain road looks like a slender thread laid across an ocean of black, the Camry a flashing blip slowly traveling its length.
"It does look dark."
Luke hasn't heard Brasher say more than a few words since they met earlier that day. He has to check the rearview mirror to make sure it's him.
"The other screen, I mean. Is that thing working over cell service?"
"Nope,"
Luke says.
"You got Wi-Fi in this car?"
"Nope."
"How's the signal getting to that thing, then?"
"We don't know," Marty answers.
"We just enter a code."
A few seconds go by before Brasher says,
"Well, shit."
"Going dark,"
Luke says, before killing the headlights. There's a collective sphincter clench throughout the Jeep, and then they're twisting up the road without headlights. Up ahead, he sees a brief, teasing glimpse of the Camry's taillights, but they're far enough away to seem like the wing lights of a plane at cruising altitude. Later, he can brag about how well he memorized the map of this particular stretch of road, but only if this next part goes well.
"How are your guys?" Luke asks.
15 minutes out."
More silence, more strained breaths, and the plastic creaking sounds of Rucker and Brasher grasping their oh-shit handles in the back seat as the Jeep weaves through the dark.
"His access road's coming up on the right,"
Marty says. Luke slows, drives right up onto the rock-strewn shoulder. A good distance uphill, he catches a glimpse of the Camry's headlights flashing across an automatic gate, sliding to one side. Then the car disappears inside. A few seconds later, what he assumes are motion-activated lights die, and his small glimpse of the gate disappears. Now it's just darkness. A minute later, he hears barks echoing through the canyon. Their ghostly distance does nothing to muffle their ferocity. Then the dogs go quiet, perhaps recognizing their owner. More darkness. More breathing. And darkness on the tablet that should be showing them everything Charlie sees. With each passing second, Luke's stomach gets a little bit colder.
"Something's wrong," Marty whispers.
"The lenses are working," he says.
"The signal's live, it's just..." "It's not the lenses, it's the drug. We're not seeing anything 'cause she isn't seeing anything."
"Give it a minute."
"The garage is 10 paces from the house, Luke. They're inside by now."
"Text your boys. See what they see."
Marty complies. A minute goes by with no response. And another. And another.
"Nothing," Marty says. "They've gone quiet. Bad cell service? We were fine at the surveillance point. We figure the casino down valley's got extra towers. Luke? All right. Everybody, guns out, let's go.
Rucker says,
What about the dogs? They don't sit when you say shoot 'em. I don't hurt dogs,
Rucker says. Seriously? Luke whispers.
Dogs didn't abduct Charlie, men did. Then fire over their heads, just not at one of us.
There's no argument. Luke grabs the tablet from its holster. If it hasn't come to life by the time they reach the gate, he'll junk it and focus on his weapon, but God willing. Somehow they're all following Brasher, who pumps his giant arms as he runs uphill. Later, Luke will think the fact that Brasher somehow outpaced all of them is hilarious, given the guy's not exactly streamlined for speed. But he's not sad to have a human tank in the lead, that's for sure. And then suddenly the tablet flashes in his hand, a bright pulse of light that blinds him. He almost trips, finds his footing. The other men notice and turn. The tablet flashes more. Not flashes. Blinks.
She's awake!
2,000 feet above the Cleveland National Forest, Ed Baker stops reciting the report he was just given by Ground Team A, and falls abruptly silent. A flash of light just pulsed through the helicopter's passenger compartment, followed by another, then another, each one giving his face a ghoulish cast. For a few seconds, he and Cole blink their surprise at each other. Then Cole pats the empty leather next to him, and Ed awkwardly settles his bulk onto the forward-facing bench seat so he can see what now fills the screen of the MacBook resting on Cole's lap. Charlotte Rowe is finally opening her eyes. First, she becomes aware of a deep, throbbing ache in her temples. As it lessens, she feels a second sensation stretching across her forehead. This feeling isn't in her bones. It's on her skin. It's scratchy and rough. The strap, she realizes. These thoughts struggle against a narcotic haze, but it doesn't feel like she's rousing from a long nap. Rather, it's like a chunk of time has been stolen from her. The exact same feeling she experienced when she came to after wisdom tooth surgery. Surgery. The word surges through her. The muscles in her neck tense, but they're the only ones. That's when she feels straps on her wrist and ankles, leather, thick, securing her to the operating table. She's blinking up into a bright glare. Against it, she sees the outline of a bulging, transparent IV bag on a stanchion. There's writing all over it. Warning labels, she realizes. And one word bigger than the rest. Acetone. While physical sensations are returning in stages, her emotions aren't coming back as quickly, and she needs them to. Desperately. Instead, her mind floats between a vague sense of alarm and a dull awareness of her situation. Something burns in her upturned right arm. 2 IVs. One small, one large. Neither one is connected to the bag of acetone. The smaller one's connected to a short cord with a port for injections. Maybe he used that port to bring her back to consciousness. Something tugs at legs that still feel mostly numb. As if from a distance, she hears rustling sounds. Looks down at her body as much as she can without moving her head. It's not rustling. It's shredding. Pemberton stands over her. He's lost the jacket and hat, and he's slowly cutting up the right leg of her blue jeans with surgical scissors. The left one's already been cut, the flaps primly laid aside so that her entire thigh's exposed. Hello, Charlotte. She's blinking up at him as he traces a finger down the side of her cheek. He's gone through her things. That must be how he knows her name. She goes to speak. She can't. There's a ball gag tucked in her mouth. Now that she's aware of it, she can feel the saliva gathering around it, coating the back of her throat. She coughs, but it's a weak effort that forces her nostrils to suck half-breaths. With each new returning sensation, she prays for the return of terror, for the arrival of bone music. But it's like grasping for hunger when your body knows it's full. Somewhere within her, the Zyprexin's locked in a cage, or stuck against a filter it's too large to slip through. Undissolved. Untapped. Untriggered.
I assume you know who I am, or you're figuring it out now.
He seems as steady and focused as if he's prepping her for a common, beneficial procedure. With the first three fingers of his right hand, he presses down softly on her cheek, as if assessing the fat content, the durability of the skin.
And that means you've probably figured out what you're going to become.
He smiles primly.
And you're not panicking, which is either a side effect of the drugs, or you think being strong will change the outcome of this.
He looks into her eyes.
It won't. You see, this face of yours, Charlotte. You realize what it is, don't you? It's just a collection of accidents, really. Genetic accidents that created the shape of your nose, your lips, your chin.
He grazes each feature as he references it.
So much of your life has been determined by this face, granted to you by this face, by how people respond to it.
But it doesn't have inherent meaning, you see.
It's cartilage, really.
Cartilage and privilege.
What I do? Now that gives it meaning. It gives you meaning, Charlotte Rowe.
He gives them all this speech, she realizes. This is what they all saw and heard before they died. He terrifies them like this on purpose. Because he is just like every other human monster, twisting truths and perverting philosophies to justify his desire to inflict pain. He traces a path down her upturned forearm, lingering at the IV injection site for a few seconds.
But I work with the whole body, you see. Your face I give to the world. Your body stays with me so I can remember the amount of effort I put into it. Into you, you ungrateful little bitch. Tell me.
He bends forward, looks into her eyes.
Did you have any sense of the man I really was when you turned up your nose at me in that parking lot? Any sense of the magnitude of what I contain? Of what I can do?
He keeps the bodies, she thinks. Then the bodies are here. The bodies are the evidence.
She feels acutely nauseated now. The after-effect of the blow he delivered to her head in the parking lot throbs persistently in her skull, rings in her ears.
And that's good. That means her body's coming back, rousing. Her thoughts are coming quicker, clearer.
No, he asks. Well, let me tell you what I'm capable of, Charlotte. I'm going to fill your system with acetone. It's going to drive out your blood, replacing most of your body fluids, and it's going to do it while you're alive and awake and remembering this moment. The moment when you realized who I am. This moment when you finally knew truth.
She blinks, sees the IV dangling from the acetone bag, waiting to be connected to her arm. Her heart races at the sight. Something's missing. The acetone goes in through the big IV, but her blood, her body fluids, how will he push those out?
She feels the cool air, subterranean air, she realizes, kissing her exposed thighs,
and that's when terror sends rivers of ice through her body from head to toe. She remembers a term from one of Luann's hospital stays, when they'd needed to draw blood and the veins in her arm weren't strong enough. A femoral stick. Pinpricks. Not from him. And then shaking in her bones. He sees it, mistakes it for pure fear, and smiles.
He can't hear the bone music, but she can. They say beauty hurts. But trust me, Charlotte, achieving meaning hurts so much more.
He turns to the supply table next to him. He gloves his hands, then picks up a loop of clear tubing that's long, thick, and attached to some kind of plunger. There's another waiting on the supply table. Two of them. One for each leg.
And when I'm done, he says,
you will be very, very beautiful.
A distant, grating sound stills him. Dogs. Barking dogs. That's when she quickly and silently pops her left hand free, as if the strap were suddenly made of paper. That's when the strap across her forehead pops off as she goes to sit up. And that's when Frederick Pemberton spins to face her. He's so stunned to find her sitting upright, so stunned to find them eye to eye, he doesn't notice when she reaches out and grabs his hand. She spits the ball gag she's bitten in half onto her lap, and he looks desperately from it to his own wrist, now clamped in her impossibly strong grip.
You are a bad, bad man, she whispers.
The bones inside his hand crunch like popcorn. A miserable yowl seems to emanate from deep within his belly. It turns into a high barking when she snaps his wrist. She swings her legs off the table. His knees hit the floor. He's shuddering, drool flying from his yawning, moaning mouth. Standing over him now, she finds her footing and squeezes down harder on his shattered wrist, drawing the limp and lifeless arm out from his body so she can keep him upright on his knees. Part of her is waiting for the same revulsion she felt when she broke Jason Briffle's shoulder, but it's not coming. All she feels is the bone music, and thanks to the terror in Pemberton's eyes, the sense that she has become not darkness, but a great fire, bringing a sudden, blazing end to it.
Did you give them all that little speech, Dr. Frederick Pemberton? Did you say it to them all so that you could see their fear?
Tears of agony spit from the corners of his squinting eyes. His breaths are wails. And the wet spot darkening his pants isn't blood, she's sure. She leans in close until they're nose to nose. He shudders.
Do you see any fear in my eyes, doctor?
His answer is a trembling groan.
Another bone, possibly his shoulder, snaps as she yanks him upright by his already injured arm.
His head rolls on his neck. His feet graze the floor like a dangling puppet's.
This is my meaning, doctor, she says. This is the truth of who I am. I'm not here to show you fear. I'm here to see yours.
She releases his arm and gives his opposite shoulder a light shove that sends him stumbling backward into a coffin-like vessel sitting a few feet from the operating table. Now that she's free, she's seeing it for the first time. It's a vacuum pump chamber, just like the one she saw online, the one he probably stole from the Bryant Center. The entire thing tilts away from her. From his wheezing breaths and glassy eyes, it's clear the impact has stunned Pemberton as badly as his blow to the head stunned her in the parking lot. The chamber's tilting. When it goes over to one side, he goes with it like a pile of bones. She starts toward him.
The dogs are barking their asses off, but none of the men could give a shit.
Later, I'll laugh about this, Luke thinks. They'll all laugh about how they stood in the dark outside a serial killer's gate, ignoring vicious dogs while they watched Charlie beat the living shit out of Pemberton on a tablet Luke held in his sweaty, trembling hands. It wasn't like they weren't ready to break in, they were. The problem was the damn gate didn't have a pedestrian entrance, just a sliding one for cars, so there was no lock to shoot off. They were trying to figure out how to distract the dogs while one or more of them jumped the fence, Luke trying to hide the tablet from the guys so they didn't panic with each moment Charlie didn't fight her way free of the table. In other words, they were about to kill the dogs. Then Charlie broke the serial killer's wrist, and Luke started shouting at everyone to stop, and everything changed. And now they're just standing there watching, watching what shouldn't be possible. And Rucker's saying the Lord's Prayer under his breath. Or maybe it's a Hail Mary, Luke isn't sure. He's never been religious.
Maybe he will be after all this.
Suddenly, the dog's attention shifts. They start running toward the fence off to their left, the one that faces the downhill slope. It takes all Luke's effort to look away from the tablet, and he has to blink in the darkness. It looks for a moment as if the brush on the far side of the fence has come to life. He thinks maybe it's the guys from the surveillance post, the ones who stopped responding after they were 15 minutes out. But these are not the guys from the surveillance post. These guys are outfitted for war. The first dog goes down with a high-pitched whine, felled by something swift and silent. Not a bullet, some kind of dart. Apparently Brasher's not the only one averse to hurting dogs. Then the second and the third. As soon as the barking fades, Luke hears a growling, chest-rattling sound, realizes it's coming from above. There's a blast of air and a blaze of light, and suddenly the four of them are grabbing onto each other and stumbling backward as a giant helicopter barrels down on them, runners extending in the moments before it touches Earth. The downdraft deafens him. Marty's gray mane has come loose from its ponytail. It dances up into Luke's face, forcing him to bat it away. The chopper lands in such a way as to pin them in between the gate and wherever the thing's spinning blades end. He'd love to know where the fuck that is exactly. They all would, so they keep stumbling backward toward the gate. Just then there's a firework-like blast off to his right. The falling spikes of the steel gate force them all to jump back in the direction of the chopper, which causes Marty to scream,
"Jesus fucking Christ, make up your goddamn minds, assholes!"
The soldiers from the brush are streaming across the house's yard now, automatic weapons raised. Helmets, visors, maybe even night vision goggles, Luke can't be sure. He counts 5 or 6 of them at least. And not a single one has the insignia of a law enforcement agency. Then the door to the helicopter opens, and the man who steps out looks vaguely familiar. He's dressed in a long, black trench coat like something out of The Matrix, a powder blue button-up, collar flapping in the wind, and big, chunky black boots that are probably some designer's expensive imitation of Doc Martens. Cole Graydon, CEO of Graydon Pharmaceuticals. You read about him in the file Kayla brought. Cole approaches him. For a delirious second, he thinks the guy's actually about to shake his hand. 3 SUVs pull up behind the chopper. At least 7 men emerge. All military-grade scary. Not combat-ready like the guys who just took down the dogs and poured across the yard, but they're packing. And maybe that means if Luke doesn't shake the guy's hand, he'll end up with one right between the eyes.
"Your passkey?" Cole Graydon says.
Luke's genuinely stumped. Cole points to his own eyes and gives Luke a broad smile. Luke digs into his pants pocket, hands Cole the digital key. Cole takes it, extends his other hand. The tablet. He wants the tablet. He wants their connection to Charlie. As if reading his mind, Cole says,
"Don't assume the worst of us. It will serve no one."
"Too late," Luke says. Cole laughs.
"How's this? Stay out of our way and no one will die."
Behind Cole, 3 of the guys part their windbreakers, revealing Glocks in hip holsters. Luke hands over the tablet.
"Thank you,"
Cole says with a smile. Then he turns and starts walking over the fallen gate toward the house.
"I wouldn't mess with her if I were you,"
Luke calls after him.
"She's in kind of a mood."
"Oh, I won't,"
Cole turns.
"Far from it.
Quite the opposite, in fact."
Then, with another smile as gracious as the one he probably gives at board meetings, he starts for the house, his own private army on his tail.
"Where is Elle Schaefer?"
she asks him for the 4th time. She's not sure if his spine is broken. She's not sure if she cares. He's sprawled on the toppled vacuum chamber, still blubbering like a baby. The pleasure's going out of it for her. The delight she's been taking in his misery is fading. She toys briefly with the idea of trying to provoke him in some way, to draw out some evidence of his evil so she can pounce on it, pounce on him. But he's broken. If not physically, then mentally. She's never seen someone truly snap, never borne witness as another human loses his mind in the course of one swift and devastating episode. How many victims of the Bannings did just that during their confinement and rape? Yards from where she ate, slept, and daydreamed. Does this square that terrible debt in some way? She's been prodding his face, grazing it, treating it just the way he treated hers. Now she grips both sides of his chin in her open palms, gently, but even that makes him shudder and sob. Where is L. Schaefer? His bloodshot, tear-filled eyes cut to the left. For the first time, she really surveys her surroundings, surveys this basement of horrors where at least two women lost their lives in a brutal, agonizing way. One wall is dominated by a utility sink and lockable metal supply closets that look like they could survive a bomb blast. To the left, the direction he just looked, are double doors to what looks like a giant walk-in freezer. She heads to it, observes the lock, grabs both handles, one in each hand, and pries the doors open with minimal effort. The lock mechanism tears in half and falls to the floor at her feet. A blast of refrigeration hits her. The space is large enough to park a car in. And they're all in there. All three of them. Elle's body is still strapped to an operating table, just like the one Charlie escaped from. But her face is missing. Toward the back, what remains of Sarah Pratt and Kelly Sumpter sit side by side on a bench. Their missing faces reveal frozen eyeballs staring out from exposed muscles and tendons. But the rest of their flesh is intact. They sit upright, held that way by lengths of wire that secure them to the ceiling overhead. They are something between mannequins and puppets, still being molded and formed into their final poses, destined, perhaps, for a rendering similar to the exhibit at the Bryant Center, only for the depraved delight of one man. Charlotte is amazed to discover that, even in this heightened state, she is still capable of tears. That even as she lays her hand gently on L. Schaefer's collarbone, as she wishes the woman some peaceful rest, that Zyprexin in full bloom in her veins does not rid her of grief or pain. For these women, for those who met their end in the Bannings' root cellar, for her mother, who loved Angel of the Morning, who might have patched things up with her father again, if only for her sake. She hears him behind her, coughing, wheezing, struggling to his feet. She knows, even as she turns, that he's going to try some pathetic last-minute defense. She also knows that she's going to kill him. He's yanked the acetone bag from the stanchion. He holds the long rod of steel in his unbroken arm as he runs for her like a gutter drunk trying to scare off the cops. She reaches out and seizes his throat with the gentlest of grips. It's enough to choke off his air and drive him backward as she walks out of the refrigerator. She carries him by his throat to the operating table, slams him into the metal, carefully straps his unbroken wrist, then realizes she tore through the other strap when she broke free. She secures his ankles instead. He barely manages to catch his breath by the time he realizes he's restrained. "Tell me, doctor," she says. "What happens if it's all got nowhere to go?" Goggle-eyed, he stares at her, shaking his head, wheezing, no idea what she's talking about, until he sees her reach down and slide the large IV port from her arm with the press of one finger against the plastic. She studies the bloody needle briefly. Then, with her other hand, she grips his left forearm just above his shattered wrist. There's enough power in even this light grip to bring his vein pulsing to the surface of his skin. She sticks him with the IV, reaches for the cord dangling from the acetone bag. What happens if the acetone goes in and all your blood and body fluids have nowhere to go? Does it just fill you up, Doctor? Does it fill you with meaning? She's never seen someone pass out from fear before, but that's exactly what he does. Nods off like exhaustion's overtaken him when it's really shock. She's considering ways to wake him up when another man's voice calls out to her from across the room. She looks up, instantly recognizes him from the magazine profile of him she read only days before. Cole Graydon. He stands at the foot of the staircase. Two bulky men in black windbreakers with military-grade buzz cuts have preceded him into the basement, guns raised. Are they aiming at her, or Pemberton, or both of them? It's impossible to tell. Because both men have seen what Cole hasn't. They've seen Kelly Sumter, Sarah Pratt, and Elle Schaefer.
Don't do that, Charlie, Cole says. Whatever you're about to do with that IV, just... take a step back from the table so we can talk.
Come closer, Mr. Graydon.
Let's avoid threats if we can. And please, call me Cole.
Come closer so you can see what your men are seeing. He complies, leaving the bottom step. When he sees what's inside the walk-in refrigerator, he goes as still as if a snake were coiled at his feet. The confidence that sparked in his eyes when she first saw him fades. His nostrils flare. She doesn't delight in his silent, muffled terror, but she thinks maybe it's just. If he is one of the architects of all this, if, like Dylan, he's tried to use her past to manipulate her, he should at least have to stand nose to nose with what that past is really made of. He turns to face her, trying his best to compose himself. It isn't working.
Come with me, Charlie. We have much to discuss.
And this thing, she asks.
What should I do with him? We'll take care of him.
I don't want him taken care of. I want him dead.
No. No, that's not true, Charlie. You want him to have never killed at all. And that's not an option. But you've done the next best thing. You stopped him.
Now you're trying to read my mind. Bend me to what you want. Just like Dylan Cody. A flash of something in his eyes when she says Dylan's name. He's still so shaken by the scene inside the refrigerator he can't hide it from her. But this is different from horror, this feeling that flares bright in his piercing blue eyes. Hurt. Betrayal.
I am not just like Dylan Cody.
There's a tremor in his voice.
And I didn't want any of this.
She believes him.
Maybe she shouldn't.
But she does.
Come with me. We'll talk. Things will become clearer, I promise.
She looks down at Pemberton, so twisted and deformed by terror, agony, and pain as to be almost unrecognizable from the man who strapped her to this very table only moments ago. She backs away from the table, rounds its foot, and starts toward Cole and the staircase. Instantly, one of Cole's men aims his gun at Pemberton. The other takes aim at her, even as he sidesteps closer to his partner and the operating table, allowing her to join Cole. Cole gestures for her to go first. I could tear you apart, she says. You know that, right?
I do. And I trust you not to. Just as I hope you'll trust me not to do anything to harm you or your men.
My men. So he's reminding me he's got Marty and Luke, she thinks. So much for avoiding threats. She steps forward. Takes the stairs carefully, one at a time. They're rickety. Too much pressure might punch a hole through them. For a moment, she thinks she's stepping into a quiet house. Pottery barn furniture, bland hotel room ready art on the walls. It's all a front for the work Pemberton did in the basement. Most of the rooms seem as neglected as the vineyard fields beyond the fence. Then she sees the glass doors to the backyard have all burst inward. There's a regiment of rifles pointed at her from all sides, through every opening, through every possible escape. Helmets, visors, goggles, black tactical gear sticking out amid the house's beige walls and clay pottery like some infestation from an alien world. It all reminds her of the SWAT team that burst from the woods and tore her from Abigail's arms. She isn't frightened, but she feels numb, dislocated. As if she's crossed a barrier into a world trying as hard as it can to deny the existence of the one she just emerged from. There will be order here, the guns of the helmeted men in black seem to say. There will be order and structure and rules. Maybe not laws exactly, but rules at least. Fat chance, assholes, she thinks. Cole walks out from behind her and into the foyer. The house's front door stands open to the driveway. Beyond, more rifles, more men in combat gear, and farther out, impossibly, the giant hulk of a helicopter that somehow landed just outside the house's front fence. With each rifle she walks past, with each soldier down in a crouch ready to fire, the momentousness of what she's capable of is somehow more apparent to her than it was as she broke Pemberton's bones. Down there, in the basement, the twisted laws of his madness ruled. Up here, she is a terrifying aberration amid firepower that could have overpowered her only an hour before. She follows Cole outside. When they reach a fallen section of fence, she sees Luke, Marty, Rucker, and Brasher standing in a huddle off to one side of the driveway, watched over by windbreaker-clad guys like the ones she assumes are taking Pemberton into custody down in the basement right now. She stops. Cole stops. "I'll bring them to you once we're done," he says. "They'll be safe. I promise you." Luke makes eye contact with her. Nods. His expression is stone cold, jaw tense, but the nod's slight enough to say it's intended just for her. She figures he's telling her to do whatever these people have said. Telling her he doesn't feel like the group's in any immediate danger if she leaves. She doesn't know whether or not to trust his judgment. For the first time, she sees the rest of Marty's crew, the guys who should have been up at the surveillance point. They're huddled with the group, too. How they got rounded up, she has no idea, but seeing them all together frightens her. Yes, she has strength. Impossible, almost otherworldly strength, but to fight off an army of this size would require coordination and skills well beyond that. "Charlie," Cole calls. "What do you want from me?" she asks. "Why can't they come with us?" "Because there isn't room." He smiles and gestures to the helicopter, as if he's inviting her to dine with him at an exclusive restaurant. He starts toward her. She feels every man in her vicinity stiffen and raise his weapon by an inch or two.
"Charlie, do you really think I'm going to try something stupid at 2,000 feet with you in your current condition?"
"You get 30 minutes. If you don't put me down after 30 minutes, with them, we'll all get to see how I fare in a crash landing."
"Deal."
His smile is bright, confident, as if he's never seen the horrors in Pemberton's basement. As if he's the type of man who'll be able to stash them away for the rest of his life. Maybe he is. There are two other men standing next to the chopper's open door. The tall, bald one radiates a quiet confidence that some of the other men lack, even as they point guns at her. The other is short, bespectacled, and his rigidity and vacant-eyed stare as she approaches could either be terror or a laser-like focus that borders on sociopathy. Or he's terrified of whatever's inside the thick briefcase he holds in both arms. Cole steps inside the passenger compartment, which she sees is much more spacious than she thought. The other two wait for her to go first. The bald one gives her a polite nod as she steps past him, as if she were any other guest. As if this were just another corporate flight on a busy CEO's calendar. Careful not to touch anything, she takes a seat on the leather-upholstered bench seat across from Cole. The engine starts up. The blades spin, slicing the glare cast by the house's security lights. The other two men pile into the helicopter after her, taking seats on opposite sides of Cole. The bald one slides the cargo door shut. Soft, golden light fills the cabin from running lights along the roof and floor. It's insane, the juxtaposition. The distance she seems to have traveled between one world and another in no more than a few paces. Then, suddenly, they're rising into the air. Her heart lurches as Luke, Marty, and the rest of them disappear under tree cover. As they ascend over the valley, she wonders if the unreality of this, rising into the air this suddenly, watching the house of horrors below shrink down to the size of a child's dollhouse, will somehow separate her from the nightmares in that basement. No, she realizes, but the memory of Pemberton's sobs will make the nightmares bearable. For the first time since liftoff, she looks into Cole's eyes. He introduces the bald man sitting next to him as Ed Baker, his director of security. Ed wisely doesn't attempt to shake her hand. When it's clear he's not going to introduce the shorter guy in spectacles to his left, Charlie says, "And who are you?" The man just stares at her.
"This is Mark Hetherington. He's also with my security team, but he has a background as a registered nurse. And when it's appropriate, and you consent, he'll take a sample of your blood."
Now Cole's staring at her, too.
"Will you allow me to do that, Charlie? Will you allow me to take a sample of your blood?"
"I'm thinking about it." Cole smiles, taps the briefcase Mark now holds on his lap. Mark pops it open. She glimpses thick foam padding with indentations holding several different vials. They look empty, but she can't be sure. Mark opens up a second compartment within, removes a thick file folder, and hands it to Cole. In turn, he hands it to her.
"Let's start with this," he says cheerfully. "I think you'll be very interested in what's inside."
40. "I'm not really good at flipping pages right now," she says. Her voice sounds like someone else's. Something between a growl and a whisper. They seem to be heading east toward the Arizona border, over mountainous terrain that will soon yield to the Anza Borrego Desert. The cabin is surprisingly quiet, given the side of the rotors overhead. A floating, padded cell. Cole reaches across the space between them, presses a button just over her shoulder. A pin spot light clicks to life, shining a bright halo down on her lap, revealing the bloodstains on her jeans, the loose flaps where Pemberton sliced the legs. Cole's nose comes within inches of hers as he withdraws, kissing distance, almost. She's not sure if he genuinely wants her to read the file, or if he wants to show her he's not afraid, but he trusts her not to tear his arm off. With all the effort she can manage, she opens the file without ripping it in half, finds herself staring down at a page printed with large side-by-side photographs, one of a toddler-aged boy who strikes her as immediately familiar. The other's Dylan. The resemblance between the two is undeniable. They share not only Dylan's sculpted chin, but also his relaxed, attentive gaze.
"I can summarize the contents if you like," Cole says. "But the file's yours to keep."
She tries to nod, but can't manage it. It's sinking in suddenly, what the page before her means, and maybe if her veins weren't inflamed with impossible strength, she'd feel like an idiot for not having seen it sooner. Of course Dylan didn't pick the Saguaro Wellness Center at random.
didn't even pick Scarlet Arizona at random, and now it's clear, most certainly didn't pick her at random. Why didn't she see it the other night